lecture on how to actually do something useful with this stuff. So last time we had randomly picked a topic area and chose speech recognition. And I'll try to draw a little better this. We had some data . So we talked about what's the first step is to essentially sample the data, get it into some kind of digital form. Second step was what? Extract the features. So we're going to essentially create a timeline, if you will. And we can draw these little tick marks every 10 milliseconds. So these are milliseconds. And at every 10 milliseconds, we're going to take data centered about, doesn't have to be centered, it can be left aligned, right aligned, but essentially some chunk of data centered about that point, which we're going to call the analysis window. And for speech processing systems, that's typically 25 milliseconds. So we have a healthy amount of overlap between each frame. And we'll then do some analysis. In the case of speech, we'll compute the energy. We will compute 12 Kepstra coefficients, which means we take the log magnitude spectrum. We take the magnitude spectrum and then take the log of it. And then we'll differentiate those 13 parameters, we'll take their first derivatives, take their second derivatives. So we have 13 features plus 13 derivatives plus 13 second derivatives. So we end up with 39 features. And that becomes then every 10 milliseconds, we have a feature vector, which is 39 dimensions. Okay, that was the signal processing part of the problem. Now we start the modeling part of the problem, or the pattern recognition part of the problem. And to do that, we need to think about exactly how are we going to architect our hidden Markov model system. Well, in the early days, we could very easily, in the days when we were working with isolated word recognition systems or small vocabulary systems, we could simply create an HMM model per word that we were trying to recognize. And that's fairly straightforward, though we'd have to think a little bit about the fact that some words are short, some words are long, so we might need different numbers of states for those words. Longer words, you would think, would take longer and larger number of states. Shorter words would take smaller number of states. We also might think about the topology of that model. If we were modeling words, we could use a fully ergodic model. Does that make sense? So first of all, let's talk a little bit about what that means. What are the states going to correspond to if this is going to model a word? So a common example we might think about in the early days of speech recognition, we worked on things like yes-no recognizers, and we worked on digit recognizers, the numbers 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 0, and 0. So let's keep it simple, and let's just talk about a yes-no recognizer, which is actually interesting, because if you ask people, if you build a system which people are allowed to say yes or no, and you build a system something like, like a telephone response system where you say, would I like to speak to an operator? How do you think people are actually going to respond to that? Well, they're going to say about 350 words in addition to yes and no. If you look across all your different speakers, yep. We actually did this experiment once. It's amazing. People will say, uh-huh, yeah, I think so, maybe, oh, I don't know. Just a second, let me ask my friend here. And on it goes. So, but let's assume for the sake of this class that they do actually behave themselves and they just say yes or no. What is this ergodic model going to represent? Okay, so we have a brave soul who suggests that the states should represent, one state should represent yes and one state should represent no. That, exactly, thank you. I was going to say, so you just wiped out my whole lecture. That's not a hidden model. That'd be a reasonable thing to do, but it wouldn't work very well. Syllables might be a good idea. Syllables or phonemes, perhaps. Yes and no actually are one syllable each. So, but let's just keep it sort of at the word level. What are the output symbols of this model? Well, so maybe I should step back for a second and say, we're building this yes-no recognizer. So let me write that. You can see why I use PowerPoint slides. My handwriting's terrible on this stuff. How many models are we going to have? So what's been suggested thus far is in a way thinking that we'll have one model with different states for yes and no. But actually the way we'd like to build this is to have two models. In a minute I'll show you actually three models. We should have a model for yes and a model for no. That would be a more classic way to approach this problem. So we're going to need a model for yes and a model for no. In a moment, I'll also convince you that we need a model for silence or background or non-speech, and I'll show you how that works in a moment. So let's talk about the model for yes. Well, one way we could think about modeling yes would be to allow each one of the states to correspond to a phoneme in the word yes. But phonemes in speech signals have durations that last anywhere from about 10, 20, 30 milliseconds out to maybe 60, 70, 80 milliseconds. So 30 milliseconds would be the equivalent of 3 frames of data. 80 milliseconds would be the equivalent of 8 frames of data. It'd be a lot to ask a model like this ergodic model that I'm showing to allow the system to continuously loop in a state for 8 frames. And remember that what we're trying to ultimately model are the statistics of the feature vectors for these words. It's the probability of what we call V, the sequence of observations, given the model, theta. So what should the state's output in this simple word-based recognition system where we're trying to model yes? No? No, no question. Now think about what we talked about with continuous distribution HMMs. What was the output of our continuous distribution HMM? What was that Gaussian modeling? And the output of that state was what? It was V's, right? V's were observations. So the state is modeling the distribution of feature vectors that are associated with that state. So what we're going to do for our yes model is build a model like this, but the output distributions at each one of these states are going to be these Gaussian mixture distributions. And they're going to model the distributions of the features that are associated with that state in a loose sense. Now, since any feature can be produced by any state, we have to deal with that problem. But the output of the model are actually, you could say in a way, Gaussian means. They're actually probabilities of feature vectors. So every time you transition from one state to the next, what does the model output? What causes a transition, or what consumes data? And what data is consumed when we make a transition? I should have mentioned at the beginning of class. Please remember to press your microphone button and talk into the microphones when you're asking a question. A couple of the remote people contacted me and said they can't hear your questions. You've got a little button on the front of those microphones. So this model that we have for yes is going to essentially consume feature vectors. Every time you receive a feature vector, it causes a transition in this model, which in turn causes an output probability. And then the overall probability of the word yes is going to be the product of those probabilities produced for each one of the feature vectors that the model has consumed. Okay? Now, given that, why does this ergodic model not make sense for speech? For this word model that we're trying to build? This ergodic model allows you to loop back in time, essentially. You can start at a state, transition to another state, transition to another state, and come back to that state. Is that a reasonable model for a signal that is what we call a left-to-right signal, a signal that evolves over time?
No.
No. Very good. You see, today's the yes-no lecture. Everything can be answered in yes and no. Why not? Well, because remember, these hidden states are going to try to model hidden properties of the data. And if your signal is evolving in time, and your signal is something like the word yes, it seems like we have a sound, another sound, and another sound. The data, the progression of the model should be sort of left to right. Now, we should allow you to stay in a state, because you might say, yes, and you might hold that sound for some time, and you want to maybe stay in that state. But at some point, you need to move on. So what the kind of model we will actually use for this, there's a couple variants, but for word recognizers, one of the more popular model looks something like this. So this is a model which says I can stay in the first state, I can arrive at the first state, we often call this the start state, and I can stay in that state, I can go to the next state, or I can skip the next state. And the reason we do that is because you want to accommodate fast talkers and slow talkers. Some people will say yes, some people say yes. And some people, and if you look at the distribution of durations for the word yes, you will find that if you allow for a expansion of a factor of two and a contraction of a factor of one half, so one half to two, that will cover most of the different pronunciations of the word yes, whether they're really fast or really slow or just average. And that's one of the reasons why we would use a model like this for word recognition. Now, for phone recognition, we use a simpler model. But we can use this model for word recognition. So we're going to have a model like this for yes, and then a similar model for no. And what we might do to be a little bit tricky. We might let the word yes is probably going to be 25% longer on average than the word no. So we might allocate more states for the word yes and fewer states for the word no. Or we could use the same number of states for both. That's actually an interesting experiment to run, but people have done both approaches. And we talk about this kind of thing in much more detail in the speech recognition class. Okay, so now we've got our two, we've got the format for our hidden Markov models. We've decided on the number of states. We've decided on a topology for the transition probabilities. What else do we need to decide upon? What? No, not yet. Just in these models. There's still one piece of this model we haven't specified. We've done transition probabilities. We've done the number of states. I'll talk about initial probability a little bit later. We will train the initial probabilities as part of the forward-backward process. But there's one more thing. What about the output distributions? What are we using for the output distributions? We said Gaussian mixtures. How many mixtures are we going to use?
Well, before you said something about 128.
Right. So what we probably want to do is to start with one mixture, one Gaussian, and then successively split that as we train more and more. So we'll go through training with one Gaussian at each state. And then once we have that system, we can split those Gaussians into two, see how that does, retrain, and split those into four, retrain. And that's a process that we actually do. It's called mixture splitting. And then we can actually look at the overall performance and the number of parameters and all these things and arrive at some optimal number of mixtures for this experiment. Okay, so there's some progress. So now we've got the models. Now we need to think about how are we going to train the models. So how are we going to go about training the models? Okay, we're going to collect a lot of data where we ask people to say yes or no. So you do that, you go into the lab and you collect thousands or millions of samples of this. What next? And I'll allow you at this point to be the professor, not the graduate student. That's really critical for this discussion. So as the professor now, you've got your million samples of yes-nos.
Is this part where you get the graduate students to label the yes-nos?
Why?
Because it needs to know whether or not it was right or wrong.
So there's the problem of, very good point, there's the problem of you created this collection system where you told all your students and friends and colleagues to call in and collect and give some data. So they call in and the computer says, welcome to John's data collection system for my PhD research. Please say yes. The first person says yes. Second person says yes. The 37th person says yes. But there's always one of these people who does what? Says no. Or what? Or, oops, I wasn't ready. So that's if your algorithm and EM training will very much do this. If your algorithm requires the data to be perfect, you've got a problem, right? So there's a couple ways we deal with that. One is we try to develop algorithms which are robust to transcription errors, labeled to the data being mislabeled. And in this case, that actually be a good approach. You could probably just go ahead and train on the data without having someone actually check it. In the older days, we would have somebody sit down and listen to the data and make sure that if the file was labeled yes, that it should in fact be yes. If the file was labeled no, it should be no. A third approach, which kind of marries these two, would be to take some really clean data, small amount of really clean data, build some models, and then go and recognize the rest of the training data and look at cases where the likelihoods were really bad and take all those files and either automatically throw them away or listen to just the ones where the likelihoods were really bad to see if those represent the outliers. And outlier detection is a whole nother area of research in this area. There's also a related concept called confidence measures and such. But we have ways where we can automatically figure out what data doesn't fit your models very well. And some of that might be attributable to mislabeled data. Some of that might be attributable to bad recognition performance. So you do this now and you get the data. You now have, let's, for the sake of argument, say that now all the data is such that if the label on the file says it's a yes, there's like 100% confidence that it's a yes. If the label on the file says no, there's 100% confidence that it's a no. But we're still not home free yet. Why? Okay, so now I give you 100 files that have the word yes in them, and I tell you to train your model. What's the problem with that? If you want this model to only reflect the word yes, well, when the system starts recording, it starts recording immediately after the announcement. Please say your number now. Please say yes now. Starts recording. You wait a couple minutes and you say, okay, yes. So there's some silence prior to when you say yes. And then it's going to take the system some time to stop recording. So there's going to be some silence after you say yes. So what you'll actually see is silence, yes, silence. Now, what if you train this model on data like this? What's this model going to learn? Exactly. This state, and maybe a few others, at the beginning of the model, are going to learn silence. And a few of the states at the end are going to learn silence. And that's not such a good thing, especially when we get to continuous speech recognition. So, being the professor and having a nice stable, as we often say, of graduate students, what are you going to do? And this is what we used to do in the old days. Exactly. How many of you have actually marked up data or worked on data as one of your first assignments as a grad student? Oh, that's unfortunate. It is important actually to understand your data before you do research. So in the old days, we used to, The newest person in the group used to get that task of collecting the data. That was sort of one of our jokes. But you might hire graduate students, undergrads, hourly workers to go and mark the data, to actually mark where the word yes begins and ends. And then you could actually train, you could cut out that section of the speech, and then you could train this model. Now, unfortunately, segmentation of the data is a very time-consuming process, and it's very expensive. So, in fact, we don't really do things that way because it's so expensive. Instead of trying to do what's called isolated word recognition, where we're recognizing yes or no, what we would rather do is add an additional model, a very important model, called silence. That's S-I-L for silence. And we actually would like to model our signal as silence, word, silence, word, silence, word. So we essentially allow, or we build a recognizer where we can have any combination of silence followed by word followed by silence. Now, what's the advantage of that from a pattern recognition point of view? Assuming we can train such a system and use it for recognition, what is the advantage of that over having the graduate students manually mark the data?
Is it that you could sort of do it on the fly? Or?
But from a performance, a pattern recognition, a statistical modeling point of view, why is that a really interesting thing to do, a really powerful thing to do? Well, first of all, in the actual application, you can't have people manually segmenting the data. The actual application, the system has to learn how to spot the signal in the presence of the file, you know, because you're going to start the recording in the actual real, on the actual system, you're going to start recording and the system's going to have to recognize and when the word is followed by any arbitrary amounts of silence. So your system has to be able to do that. But from a pattern recognition point of view, in the process of training this system, you're actually training, you're using the HMM technology to essentially train a segmentation algorithm. Segmentation and recognition are both done simultaneously as part of the hidden Markov model system. And as you gain more experience with signal processing applications, you will learn that segmentation is a very large part of the problem. Knowing where to look for the data is a very large part of the problem. So it's better to do that on a statistical basis using this very powerful technology that we have. But it makes the recognizer a little more complicated, because now we're going to have a high-level control, which we often call the grammar. Which is going to look something like this. There's a couple of ways you can do this, but what I've drawn here is essentially a high-level control that allows arbitrary amounts of silence followed by one word followed by arbitrary amounts of silence. So this HMM system, or this language model, can output sequences like W. It can output sequences like SIL, W, SIL. It can output things like W, SIL, SIL, W. You can go SIL, W. But there always has to be at least one W, and W is going to represent our word. Then for our low-level control, we're going to let W represent either yes or no. So I could have actually written two states here, one corresponding yes and one corresponding no, but it's just as easy to let this symbol expand into two alternate symbols. And we can actually do that through another network. And you'll notice that these models are actually not hidden. These are essentially finite state machines that are observable. The symbols that they output are directly the symbols that we observe. And the states in these models correspond to the states we're interested in, like the words yes and no. And then we're going to have an acoustic level. Where we're going to have a model for yes. That might look something like this. Probably that. Ignore this last one. So you might have something like that. And then we have a silence model that looks like that. So what we've actually done is to build this into a hierarchy of finite state machines. We have what's called a language model, which describes sentences. We call these often sentences. In terms of words, we have a pronunciation model, which describes words in terms of states. The pronunciation level often will describe words in terms of phonemes. I'll talk about that in a moment when we get to bigger vocabularies. And then we have an acoustic level, which describes phonemes in terms of states. And this is why with most technology like this, we actually now have a search problem, in that you can think of this as an artificial intelligence type search problem. When at time zero, we have to allow all possible paths through all these models. And as we then decode the utterance, we're essentially finding the best path through this very large network. But I don't want to talk about that too much because that really will get us too far into speech recognition. But I want to talk a little bit about how we train these models and then why we might want to introduce an additional hidden layer of phonemes. We'll talk about those two things today. In terms of the overall problem, remember we talked with Bayes' rule about the fact that there's the acoustic model, the language model, and the evidence. We ignore the evidence, and the language model expresses the priors for the words. The acoustic model expresses probabilities of feature vectors in terms of symbols. So all this upper level stuff is what we call the language model, and we can do that many, many different ways, but you know, that you learn about that in natural language processing course. One of the popular approaches to speech recognition today is to actually take all these networks, combine them into one very, very large finite state machine. That network may have millions and millions of nodes. And then to do graph reduction on that network, what's called graph minimization. And in doing that, we've actually been able to build recognizers that can recognize millions of words in real time because you're making use of a lot of really fancy graph search technologies and things. But again, that's sort of outside the scope of this course. But the importance of this approach is that now we can handle situations where we have arbitrary numbers of words in the file. So someone could actually say yes, 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 no, yes, no, yes, no, and you can handle that. But we still need the data to be labeled in terms of we need to know what's in each one of the files. And typically for speech recognition, we only need to know the word sequence. So what I would have my graduate students do in this case, or my hourly workers, is to label, if we were dealing in an application where the files contain multiple words, they would just go in, listen to the word, and write yes or no, or maybe yes, 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 no, whatever was spoken. They would just write the words. They would not have to actually align them. Just write the words. And then the neat thing about the way forward-backward training works is that what we do during training is to take that word-level transcription. Let's say they spoke yes, yes, no in the file. So let's say you had a file where they said yes, yes, no, no, yes. You take that information, you expand it into models. You take the yes, map it to the model for yes. You take the no, map it to the model for no. You insert silences between the words because you don't know how much silence was there, so you have to allow for an optional silence between words. And then you basically expand this into one big network. So it's one big state machine that in it explains this particular utterance. And now you're finally ready to start the forward-backward algorithm for that utterance. So now you run, and I'll explain that a little bit more in a moment, but you run forward-backward algorithm on that utterance with that state machine. And as you process each frame, you go through the forward-backward iteration, and you save the accumulated probabilities, the alphas and the betas, for all the states. And then you come back and you do this for the next file. You take the transcription, build the network, train the network, save the accumulated probabilities, and then you repeat. You do this through the entire training database, and when you're done, then you can take the total accumulated alphas and betas and apply your re-estimation equations and re-estimate the A's, the B's, and all these parameters we talked about. And then you go back and do it all over again. Now, the neat thing about this is you can actually start these models with minimal information. In the early days, we actually used random values for the models. Today, what we actually will use our previous model sets that we have laying around. And I know for graduate students, that creates a problem because if you're new to a field, you don't have a previous model set. But you go to your professor and say, give me the previous models. You use those to seed your models. And then you do this process. And after only about 3 iterations, you will actually get really good models, even though you're starting these models from very, very minimal information. So EM converges fairly quickly. Now, coming back to the EM algorithm, or to forward-backward algorithm, so you've expanded for each of these utterances, you have this big network now, big finite state machine, that essentially describes this utterance in terms of all these different states. And remember when we postulated the forward-backward algorithm, we said it's really like a trellis. You take your state machine, you lay it out like a trellis, and then you just proceed down the trellis and do the computations. And that's all we actually do. Only there's still too many possible states. And not all those states are possible, really, at every point in time. So we actually prune the trellis based on probabilities so the training runs much faster. But again, that's a detail we don't have to worry about in this course. Now, the even more interesting thing is that lately, to train acoustic models, people have actually been doing unsupervised training. They simply start with a decent set of models, maybe from your last generation of the technology, and they just update, they essentially process these utterances with no constraints on the words. But they do this across very, very large amounts of data. To do supervised training, you can get a pretty decent speech recognizer with about 3 hours of speech or less. About 3 hours of speech is good. 1 hour of speech we can work with. To do unsupervised training, you can actually get performance that's very good, in fact, sometimes better than that, than what you get with 1 hour of data, if you're willing to process several thousand hours of data. And this is one of the areas where the field is really focusing right now, is how much, if we have access now to millions of hours of data. We can process thousands to hundreds of thousands of hours on our supercomputers these days. So we're increasingly saying, well, let's just do unsupervised training on large amounts of data rather than do supervised training on smaller amounts of data. I talk a little bit about that in the adaptive signal processing course. I won't talk about that too much in this course, but that's it's an interesting topic to think about. So when all of this is done, you've now got the parameters for your model, and you simply turn this around and do recognition. When a new utterance comes in, you essentially find the best path through this network, noting that each one of these symbols expands to a lower network, which expands to a lower network. So you have kind of a hierarchical graph search problem, which we again can pose either. We can actually solve that using forward-backward algorithm, or we can use a Viterbi search. There are a number of different search strategies for that. But all you really do, when the utterance comes in, you try to compute the overall highest probable sequence of models. So the way we can do that with forward-backward, where we consider all possible paths that could have produced that input utterance. Or we could do that with Viterbi, where we take the single best path. We tend to prefer to use Viterbi because it's much faster. So we actually use a Viterbi algorithm to recognize. We compute, as the data comes in, we essentially find the best path through this model, and then the corresponding state gives us the word sequence. So what comes out might be sill, 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 word, sill, 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 and then you just look at the word and declare it yes or no. So recognition is actually fairly straightforward once you have the models trained. It's the training that takes a little bit of programming and a little bit of data processing and such. Now, the neat thing about this is we can easily extend this approach to very, very large vocabulary speech recognition. We just need to allow any word here and allow multiple words. So what we actually do for large vocabulary speech recognition the grammar becomes in some ways much simpler. You allow any word or silence, and you allow arbitrary amounts of that. So this system can output things like sill, 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 sill. Or it could output sill, word, sill. Or it could output sill, word, word, sill, and so on and so forth. This is what we often call a loop grammar, and this allows any combination of silences and words, arbitrary numbers of those. And we can run, we can do this to, for example, for large vocabulary speech recognition. However, if we do that, what type of information are we ignoring in the Bayesian approach? Remembering that this is a speech recognition problem, and remembering that the Bayesian approach says that we have two components to our probability, the probability of the acoustics given the words times the probability of the words, right? This is not making use of probability of words. The probability of words is what we call the language model, and we can use a model for English, for example, to improve these probabilities, because we know, for example, basic grammar, we know syntax, we have some domain knowledge. We can use all that to train language models. And in fact, what we use for language models sometimes is very simple. We just condition this probability on the current word and two previous words. It's called an n-gram model. And it essentially uses three words, the current word, the probability of the current word as a function of the two previous words. We can also use more complicated models where we look at parts of speech and word senses and all that kind of stuff. That's a lot of what natural language processing is all about. Now, the last thing I wanted to mention here is that, so now we've got a large vocabulary speech recognizer. We're making use of linguistic information. But what about the acoustic models? What makes sense to use as acoustic models if we want to recognize millions and millions of words?
We were talking before about using phonemes.
Exactly. It would make sense to use some lower unit that is shared amongst all these different words. And fortunately, language gives that to us in the form of, linguistic theories tell us that every language has a core set of phonemes, about 40 to 60 sounds. So, and across all languages, there's about 250 of these sounds across all languages throughout the world. So you might think about building what's called a universal phone set that covers all phonemes that could occur in any language, or you might build a phone set for the specific language that you're interested in, like English, where we use about 40 sounds. However, we don't just use the sound itself because the sound is short. We actually use the sound conditioned on the previous sound and the next sound, and that's what's called a triphone. So our acoustic models, we will have for every possible three-phone combination in English, we will have an acoustic model of three states, a three-state model with just simple. We actually use, for the phone models, we use simple three-state models that look like this. No skips, just three states. And we'll have maybe 10,000 of those to represent the 10,000 most common three-phone sequences that can occur in English. There's 40 sounds times 40 sounds times 40 sounds, but then you kind of reduce that. And then what we'll actually do is take all those models, those 10,000 three-state models, and reduce the number of states through clustering, maybe by another factor of three or so. So we'll share states between the models. Some phonemes that are similar will share some of the states in their models. So that's how you recognize what you might call time-synchronous signals or left-to-right signals using HMMs. Does that help? Does that give you some better appreciation of how all this fits together? So if you have more questions on this, email me and I can point you to, I've got a lot of lecture slides from my speech recognition course and other things. But I think you get the basic idea that in this theory we deal with kind of the simple problem, but to actually apply that technology to a real application, there's always a lot of these little practical considerations that you have to worry about. Okay, that's it. I will see you on Monday. Oh, so the exam is going to be next Friday at 1 to 1:50 p.m. in 130 Simrall. I'll send a message about it, but 130 Simrall is just over down the hall there.